Thanks for listening to the Mo Better Bands podcast. If you have something to share, click the links in the show notes of your podcast app and leave us a message. Or email me directly at donovan@springfieldmusic.com. That's D-O-N-O-V-A-N @springfieldmusic.com. If you'd like to be a guest, would like to recommend a guest or a topic, shoot me a line. Thanks again for listening.
Hey, everybody, and welcome. This is Donovan Bankhead with Springfield Music, and I appreciate you dropping in and listening to the podcast. With the Mo Better Bands podcast, my intention is to talk with our fellow educators across the state and share some of their best tips, tricks, and best practices. Also, maybe even share some of the things that they're struggling with so that we can help each other out, because we're all dealing with so many of the same issues in your programs. And us, as your school music dealer, want to try to be a resource to help you solve some of these challenges and issues. So anyway, we always appreciate you listening. And if you have ideas or tips or would like to be featured on the podcast, reach out to me and let me know. Donovan@springfield-music.com. All right, let's jump in.
All right, well, today my guest is Ron Sykes. And Ron began teaching in the Jefferson R. 7 School District, which is in Festus, Missouri, in 2000. And his responsibilities there basically include everything from 6th grade band through 12th grade, 6th through 12th grade band for band, a jazz band, salsa band, everything that kind of comes up. His middle school and high school bands consistently achieve superior ratings in all areas. And in 2011 and 2015, the Jefferson High School Concert Band was selected to perform at the Missouri Music Educators Association Convention. In addition to his many teaching responsibilities, Ron maintains a busy schedule as a clinician, composer, percussionist, drum set artist, fratoist, and jazz vibraphonist. So, Ron, welcome, and correct my pronunciation of the fratoist, and tell us what that actually is.
Well, thanks for having me. It's the pronunciation is fratois, which fratois. is French for rub board. So that instrument is commonly used in Cajun and Zydeco music, more so Zydeco, because Zydeco comes from the Creole tradition, whereas the Cajun, you'll hear a little bit of rub board in Cajun music, but primarily that's going to be like triangle and stuff like that. But yeah, fratois. I played in a band called Gumbo Head for about 12 years, starting in year 2000, where I played percussion and then would pick up the rub board on all the Zydeco songs.
So is that something that you have to go back and get an advanced degree for, or can you just get a certificate in fratois performance?
Well, what it is I got my DMA from University of Phoenix, and I got online. I just submitted a video, and there was a jury of three Creole musicians, and I passed.
Nice. Well, at least they were Creole. I mean, that's legit, I think, at that point.
Absolutely.
Well, that's really cool. I'm super excited to have you on the podcast today. When I started this and asked a couple of the first guests who they would ask me to talk to next, your name has come up a bunch of times. And matter of fact, I was even doing an episode yesterday that I was recording with Lisa McMahon, and she mentioned that you should be on here as well. And then when I already told her, oh, I'm talking to him tomorrow, she was so excited to hear what you were going to say. So, so you've got a fan club for sure. So
too kind.
And the other thing that's kind of cool for me is I think Facebook has been trying to get us connected for about 4 years, because I've seen you've been on my list of like people Facebook's like, you've got to know this person, like you have 100+ people in common, and like, not, we never met, like I'm not sending the friend request until we've at least had some opportunity to actually connect with one another. So it's now nice to finally get to do that.
Yeah, the thing about Facebook, well, first of all, it's a small world. And the music education world is even smaller. So it would make only sense that Zuckerberg tried to connect us.
That's right. It's true. Yeah. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. So there's a ton of things, and because you've been teaching now for 21 years, and there's a lot of things you could talk about. But when we were kind of chatting back and forth, there was a couple topics that really stood out to you. And so today I think we're going to be primarily focused about your thoughts about band methods, and then also life and teaching in a rural school. But I want to start with band methods, because that's something I think is going to be really, I'm definitely interested in hearing your opinion on that. I kind of have thoughts of it as well. But tell me, like, when it comes to band methods, what where's your heads at that?
Throw them away. Throw them away. Get rid of all of them. They're all awful. Even the one I wrote for myself. They're awful.
Cool. And then what about teaching at a rural school?
End of podcast. Thank you so much for coming. No, well, and here's why. I say that, you know, kind of tongue in cheek, but I think the biggest problem with methods is method books give you the feeling that if I open up the book and I teach page per page, year after year, then I'm going to get the same results. And if I don't, it must be the student's fault. That's my biggest problem. It's like, yeah. It's not a silver bullet. It's not a catch-all, you know, and I get a kick out of everybody that says, well, ours is a comprehensive method, you know, and sometimes the comprehensive methods they're too dense and they're written for an older student. So, and all of my opinions and thoughts have come through, you know, 20 something years of trial and error. And in my first couple of years of teaching, like everyone else, when one's in college, part of your methods class is, of course, to buy one copy of every book and do a compare and contrast analysis and determine which book you should start with in your first year of teaching. And when I started, I think I started with Standard of Excellence, right? Mm-hmm. No problem at all. But I was teaching a fifth grade band. I saw every kid by myself for about 30 minutes a day in a very small music classroom. And we had about anywhere between 40 and 55 kids in beginning band that I saw every day. And I started flute, clarinet, saxophone, trumpet, trombone, and percussion. So I was juggling all of those instruments, only getting 30 minutes a day. Now, granted, I love teaching that class and teaching every single day. But if I would have followed that method and said, all right, look, book one is year one, book two is year two, we didn't get through the book, right? So then there's like, questioning and anxiety, like, what am I doing wrong as a teacher if I can't get the students through the book? And come to find out, like, our situation and our scheduling determined how far we were going to get. Mm-hmm. So, and then I also felt that even in a situation where you would start at the very beginning of the method book and you would go to the very end of book one, and I don't care what book it is, there's still so many holes in the student's learning that's not covered by that book that still have to be addressed. The method books will all cover tone production as well as they can in print, but mm-hmm. they barely cover articulation. They gloss over it. You know, they talk about it, but to call something comprehensive would, you know, lead me to believe that everything should be included all the time. So there's also very little work with a chromatic scale. In a beginning method book, the students would never get out of like the three basic keys of B flat, E flat, and F, mm-hmm. right? So what I started doing was kind of after the first year or so, I just started kind of jotting down, because at that point, our school district was only K through eight. And the students that were finished with eighth grade, they would go on to one of our neighboring high schools. And as a teacher, I wanted to make sure that I wanted to best prepare my students for that high school experience. So it didn't matter what school they went to. I wanted them to walk in, be competent and confident in their abilities so that they would just blend in with wherever they were going to go. Mm-hmm. So I started like, all right, well then for that to happen, by the time they leave eighth grade, they should be able to do A, B, C, and D by the time they do this. And I just started like rotating back and saying, all right, by the time they're done with fifth grade, what is the absolute most important thing? And then that is what focused my entire curriculum. So then at that point, instead of the method book becoming the entire curriculum, it really should be a supplement to the actual curriculum.
Gotcha.
Right? So then I started writing out my own exercises. I'm like, in that beginning book, there was nothing in there that even remotely looked like the Remington. Well, I want the kids to learn, you know, the Remington before they leave. It's a simple mm-hmm. chromatic passage. It's great for building tone and breath support and all that good stuff that as directors, we all know. There's no reason why we have to wait, you know, until they're in seventh or eighth grade or high school to show this great exercise. So I was like developing. So I was like, all right, my first chapter is just going to be development on tone quality that fits the age appropriateness of a beginning band student. Right. And then after I would like had a couple years of building these exercises, the ones that worked, I kept. The ones that stunk, I threw out or modified. Then it was like, all right, well now, and I should also preface this by saying that when I was student teaching in the Melville district with the legendary Mary Petrillo, which if anybody's listening knows what an amazing educator she was. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and I say, and I don't take this lightly, I would take a bullet for that woman. She is an amazing person. And she taught me a whole lot. And part of that was she had like this library of videos. And one of them was Dr. William Ravelli working an honor band. So, and they videotaped the rehearsal and then released it on one of some label or something. So I'm watching this video and Dr. Ravelli, he asks the kids, the high school kids in the honor band, you know, what are the five characteristics of a satisfying musical performance? None of them in the room could answer. Mm-hmm. Should we get the right note? Hey, that's important, but that's number four. So he started and said, the most important is your tone, your tone quality. You know, musicians are judged. I'm sorry, people are judged by the friends that they keep, and musicians are judged by the tone they create. Tone is number one. So I was like, oh, I jot that down. So I'm going to build a bunch of exercises that just focus on tone for beginners. And then he said, number two is intonation. His concept was once you have a good sound, you put it in the right spot. So then I was like, oh, so I need to come up with a bunch of exercises that help with intonation. And I started jotting all those down and experimenting with those. That's where we started doing way more play by ear that's ever brought up in method books, right? Mm-hmm. So play by ear and doing some solfege. Yes, we sing in band. I'm not ashamed of it. I don't do it great. I don't do it well at all, but we do it. And then it's like, all right, now that you have a good tone and it's in the right spot, well, now you have to play it at the right time. And that's where rhythm comes in. So I developed all these exercises that just help kids with rhythm, everything from rhythmic dictation. I use a different counting method than what's out there. It's basically the one and or one and, but I, instead of and, I use up because I want the kids to visualize an upbeat. So a series of eighth notes will say one up, two up, three up, four up. So, and we'll also do like a body motion. I know this is a podcast, but I'm dancing in my seat trying to explain this. But, you know, but we get the kids physically involved in rhythm by when we count one up, two up, I have them all stand and I make them, you know, actually hop up on their feet a little bit so they start feeling the upbeats, you know, plus I'm getting them ready for like ska music, which is cool. Letting them feel upbeats and ska music. That'd be great.
Ska music, which is cool. I mean, you had me until that last line, but continue.
That's all right. So anyway, teaching different rhythm. And also I didn't like that, you know, most of the rhythms in the early beginning band methods were starting with whole notes. So automatically you're jumping all of these steps to the kids stating, all right, here's your whole note. Now I need you to divide it. When we all know the first thing we ever learned was addition. Mm-hmm. We learned addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. But beginning band, we say, hey, divide first. So I started with saying, no, I want kids to add. Let's start adding, right? So I start off teaching 16th notes. That's the first rhythm I ever teach. Because then after I have 4 16th notes, I can add 2 16th notes together and get an eighth note. I can add 2 8th notes and get a quarter note. I can add 2 quarter and just keep adding. And then as I'm adding, I'm subtracting by throwing in rests. And then we can multiply. And then finally, we can subdivide. And then by the time we get to that whole note, they can divide out because they've been thinking 16th notes and eighth notes the whole way out. So then that was chapter three. Chapter four from Dr. Ravelli is, so you've got a good sound, you've put it in the right spot, and you're playing it at the right time. Now you have to play the right note. Now, most kids think the right note is way more important than step four, but it's not. Because if you play a right note at the wrong time, it's a wrong note. Now that we've got the first three steps, our fourth step is technique. How do we know our scales? You know, do we know our arpeggios and whatnot? So in step four, and also key signatures. So this was another sticking point with methods because they only covered B flat, E flat, and F. Well, I want kids to learn more keys than that. So by the time my sixth graders are finished, I'm sorry, well, I would say nowadays because I've got beginning band in sixth grade, but by the time my kids are done in sixth grade, they have played in all 12 major keys. They're not doing anything like outlandish. They're not playing Donna Lee or, you know, transposing, you know, the Hindemith. But what they're doing is they're taking simple tunes like Hot Cross Buns, Twinkle Twinkle, you know, Starlight, Star Bright, and they're playing them in 12 keys. Because when they can play in 12 keys, it then starts helping their ear training because then they start hearing, well, wait a minute, Hot Cross Buns sounded good here. It sounded good here. Why didn't it sound good here? Well, it was because of that key signature that we're not looking at right now. Mm-hmm. Oh, here and now let's revisit the scale. Let's revisit the scale. Now let's play Hot Cross Buns. Now it sounds right. Yes? Yes. So now the kids are self-correcting based on what they're hearing. The moment that that kids only play in one key or two keys or three keys, they're not developing a sense of pitch. They're developing a relative sense of everything must sound like in this key. Once they start playing outside of that standard three keys, like their ear training improves and their pitch correction as they get older is almost immediate because now they know what a major scale sounds like or what a minor scale sounds like. And they can start wrapping their head around that too. So it's ear training as well. And then after they've got the technique and the right notes and all that good stuff, the fifth part of Dr. Ravelli was the interpretation. And that's where everything else comes into play. You know, you can put in, of course, dynamics. Are we attacking and releasing together? Are we playing in the proper style? Is it legato? Is it a march? Should it swing? The interpretation part is everything else. So if we can master the first four levels, then the fifth level is like just euphoric making music all the time. So with that in mind, like I said, that was during student teaching. So I started jotting out all these notes about how I'm going to cover each of those five things. And then that's how I started teaching each day, making sure I cover all five of those, but each day focusing really on one. And then there's 5 days in the week and we would just rotate them down. So after a couple of years, I had all these exercises that I was constantly, you know, copying and throwing to the kids and we'd run through them. And then it's like, all right, well, let's open up this method book and play this song. So I started realizing that really I'm only using this method book now as a way to play, you know, melodies and just to play. I was only using the method books for the melodies at that point. So I was like, well, I'll just take these public domain tunes and kind of put it together. So that first method book that I wrote, you know, 15 years ago was taking those melodies and transposing them in different keys. So every day we just open up our book and went boom, 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 boom. And I was like, man, I'm feeling really good about this. Even a couple schools used that method for a couple years. And then after a while, I came back to my own method and I was like, this sucks. I don't like it. No, it's different. So then I just, you know, modify everything. And that's kind of been the way it is. I just modify things year after year after year because everything changes. Your instrumentation changes. Sometimes your schedule changes. Sometimes so instead of taking this book and going, it's going to work year after year, student after student, and it's going to be amazing. It's more of like going to the doctor and saying, you know, I don't want the doctor to prescribe to me the same medicine all the way throughout the day, right? Yeah. Every patient's different. Every band's different. So, you know, to me, a music educator is going to listen to a band and then kind of diagnose it and say, well, this is what I think we need to work on. And then find every resource material to make that happen, to improve upon that.
Yeah, but they are going to have a basis of things that are going to be in there. So if we're thinking about that doctor analogy, you know, you're going to have fruits and vegetables, diet and exercise, like there's going to be staples, and with bands there's staples too. But then as you move along, you're right, there may be some things you need to specialize in. So I love this. Let me kind of like share the thoughts in my head on a couple of these things. So first of all, I love this idea of taking Ravelli's, you know, 5 points and really like kind of analyzing and think about your band with it. And you're right to have that first one is tone, because I've certainly seen bands where it's like, okay, like technically you did play exercise number 34, But did you hear it? Like, because I don't know that I would say that it was like play. I mean, like you got through it, but it doesn't sound, not with a characteristic sound or something like that. I mean, I guess technically you had the right pitch and technically you had the right rhythm. But if the trumpet didn't sound like a trumpet and the flute didn't sound anything like a flute, then like, did you really? So I think putting tone first is so smart. And then intonation, one of the things that I have seen over the years always drives me nuts is the schools and the programs. And I'm not trying to call anybody out here if this is you, okay? Just so please don't take offense. But where we tune the day of the concert. And we tune because the band director has the tuner and he's like, okay, pull out, push in. You know, and tuning that way, I'm like, oh, why bother at this point? Like it doesn't matter. The kids have learned the whole time to play the way they've been playing. They're gonna, no matter what you do with the tuning slide or the mouthpiece, they're gonna play with the same intonation they have played. So having those things be something that you're intentionally working on from the beginning, I think is genius. Like it's the thing that's missing in so many of our ensembles, and especially that skill of playing by ear. I mean, that's really how our craft got created, was, you know, just hearing something and recreating it. And most students today, like, just can't do that. So I think that's so smart. I think the thing I would wonder about is Lisa Mann and I yesterday had a really interesting conversation about this era right now, the COVID era, being so difficult to teach the same amount of content that we normally teach, especially if you're hybrid or virtual or something like that, that the kids don't have their horns on their faces as much as maybe they did before. And so it's changed her on what some of the things that she used to think were her non-negotiable standards. She's been changing it a little bit as we go through this COVID era. And we had this specific discussion about keys. You know, how necessary is it for a middle school student to be able to play in all 12 keys when in reality, so I play trumpet and bass and guitar, but as a trumpet player, I mean, I'm pretty much never playing in C sharp or C flat. You know, there's some grade 5 literature and stuff where I might see it, but other than that, I pretty much never have to. I got 4 or 5 keys that I'm going to see 90% of the time. Not that there's anything wrong with knowing how to play in all 12 keys, but you certainly want to be very good at playing in the 4 or 5 that you're going to see all the time.
Well, I think playing in multiple keys does a couple things. Again, like I mentioned earlier, it's also an ear training exercise. It's ear training for the most part. Mm-hmm. But also just exposing the kids to knowing that possibility is out there, you know, instead of limiting them. No one is as proficient in B major as they are in B flat major. Okay. However, if you say take hot cross buns in B flat major and just take it up a half step, it rewires their brain. So it's sometimes not necessarily necessary. Well, I'm being redundant. It's not necessarily to be like that proficient in all the keys. And I do agree with that, mm-hmm. but just that exposure to them, it's like cross training. Okay. I love playing mandolin. I am awful at it. Okay. I'm not proficient at it. I'm not going to show up to a jam session, but the moment that I started just working on a few mandolin ideas, it automatically did 2 things. It rewired my brain to put me back at the position of a beginner, mm-hmm. and go, aha, I need more patience sometimes, because mm-hmm. with the way I feel now is the way that clarinet player feels when they're working over the brick. All right. So slow mm-hmm. down, Sykes. It'll be all right. That's one thing. But just because I'm not necessarily going to play a gig on mandolin doesn't mean there's not value in learning something about it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So that's sure. that's how I view learning the other keys as well.
I could see that. I could see it. It's not that you're trying to have equal dexterity and competency in the keys, but the awareness that they exist. I remember I often reference my wife, because she's the one that actually has the band directing career in our family, and her first teaching job, she gets, you know, the kids are all together and she's like, all right, you know what, let's just play the B flat scale. And so she has her hands up and like she's waiting for the kids to get their instruments up, and the kids are kind of all looking at each other, and she puts her arms in and she said the B flat scale, and they arms back up, And the kids stop, and finally one raises his hand and says, Mrs. Bankhead, do you mean the scale? And she's like, thus, let's see what happens when we play the scale. And so B goes down, it's the B-flat scale. And then, so they play the B-flat scale, and then another kid raises his hand and says, so does that mean there's more than one scale? Mm-hmm. This is her high school band. Yep. And she's just like, oh my God, like this is my life now. Like trying to straighten out what these kids have been in band for 5 years. How do they not know, not even that they're the name of the scale, but there's more than one. But this topic's also reminding me of something, and I kind of want your opinion on this. So in the conversation that I had with Matt, we were talking about one of his things that he does when teaching beginning jazz improv is assigning this a number to scales, to the notes of the scale, and then having kids start to think about, you know, the notes of the scale, that arpeggios of chords. And so if we're thinking about hot cross buns, instead of just thinking about that it's D, C, B flat, thinking it's 3-2-1. And if you start thinking, well, it's 3-2-1, all right, well, then now what it would be, what would hot cross buns be in concert F? Okay, well, if it's 3-2-1, I guess it'd be A, G, F, right? And so if you do that, you can kind of get them like transposing, and you could be thinking about all kinds of other things that you're introducing even in that beginning band level. And then when it comes time for jazz improvisation or something like that, they're already familiar with some of the terminology and lingo.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly that's my exact approach, is using the number system, because then as they transpose through the keys, then you can also start incorporating the different terminology and nomenclature from jazz and say, all right, now that you've played Noel, and even with major scale, it's like, all right, well, now we're going to do 3-2-1 in B flat. Great. Now, what would happen if you flat the third? And then you get to talk about what that word even means. It's like, all right, flat the third. All right, well, now you just turn that into B flat minor. And the kids are like, what? Or if, all right, kids, now you're going to flat the third. And now you use those three notes and solo over this. You can take hot cross buns now and solo over this chord change just by flatting that third. What do you think about that? Their kids are like, oh, that's crazy.
Well, and yeah, and now you're teaching this whole thing about, like, you know, what is major and minor even mean? What does that sound like? What are the sound concepts that we have when we hear that? Like, it's a much more in-depth and engaged conversation than, you know, playing line 16.
Well, here's a fun thing to do that we've been doing here every Friday, and the kids absolutely love it. And I'll have a big bag of suckers or Jolly Ranchers or whatever I have, and we will play. Have you ever been to a trivia night and played heads or tails?
No.
All right. So heads or tails would be, everybody would stand up, and it would be like dead or alive. Okay. So they would read off a person's name, and they would say, all right, is this person dead or alive? If they're alive, put your hands on your head. If they're dead, put your hands on your hip. So then they would go through and say, all right, who's somebody that's alive right now? Beyonce. All right, so it's Beyonce, dead or alive? And then everybody would put their hands on their head, and then you'd say, all right, anybody who put their hands on their hips would be wrong, and they'd have a seat, right? It's a pretty quick game. So we started doing that, heads or tails, with major and minor. So I'll be on the piano. It's a quick little bell ringer, right? If you're tired of your warm-ups, if the kids are getting stale, you're like, all right, kids, it's Friday. Everybody stand up. All right, I'm going to play a major scale, right? And if I play a major scale, put your hands on your head. If it's minor, on your hips. And I'll go through, and we'll play it until finally there's one kid down. He gets, you know, the candy, and we move on with rehearsal. And then, and you'll notice they will get better and better. And I had to start going faster and faster. And then I started incorporating chords. And then after I did chords, like major and minor chords, mm-hmm. then I just went from, in jazz band, I did it with high schoolers and did like, here's a major chord and here's a dominant seventh chord, right? And then played game that way. So you can modify it based on the kid's ability level. But yeah. That's another quick little ear training thing that kids love, because it, you know, they're now listening to it going, no, I think that's major. And then you start noticing different patterns. So kids, if I hung around in the middle register of the piano, then the kids could like determine major or minor a little easier. The moment I started going down, the students automatically thought it was minor. If I went up the keyboard, they automatically thought it was major.
It was very interesting.
And then after a while, I started like, you know, playing around with that. And then the kids would be like, oh, then they started hearing the qualities in the different registers too. So that's something else that I had not considered, but that was fascinating.
What about inversions? Do you use chord inversions so that they're...
Dude, I'm a percussionist. Everything's in root position, man. No, I'm teasing. Actually, I haven't done any real inversions yet. No. Just the major.
Yeah,
minor,
just curious.
En route. Yep.
Yeah, and even I wonder how well they would do if you also just like open the chord, so that instead of like, you know, just kind of in one hand position or whatever, if it's over, you know, two hands separated apart, where you're playing the notes a little further apart.
I did do that. I did separate them a little bit to try to get rid of the notion that everything low is minor and everything high is major. Yeah.
Well, because sometimes that separation can make things sound different. You play seconds together and they can sound like they clash, but you play a ninth and a ninth sounds nice, you know? Yes. So just that spacing can trick your ears sometimes too.
But that's
fascinating, man. I love that idea, and that helps so much. Like you're helping, first of all, you're creating musicianship. Even at that young age, like they're starting to have an ear and develop an ear. And that is going to become very useful, of course, for any kid who goes into jazz band for improvisation. But even if they don't, like students having an ear and paying attention to what they're playing in their concert music is super beneficial. And it's something that's lacking with a lot of our kids today. They kind of have no idea if things are... I say that as if it's every kid in every program. It's not. But it's something I see in a lot of schools where... the kids don't have a good concept of tone or intonation because they haven't worked on it. They've worked on rhythms and note placement.
Yep.
And that's been it. And maybe technique. And that's about it. But you're right. They've kind of skipped those first two steps. And I love the other thing you mentioned about chromatics and chromaticism, because as a brass player, and I guess any instrument, it's always perplexed me why we don't deal with more chromaticism, just at least in the beginning, to kind of help a student understand what the keys are doing, because there's a pretty logical way of most instances or often enough of how keys are falling and the way they go, and for kids to sort of make that connection. The most obvious one, of course, would I guess probably be like the you know, maybe the mallet, one of the mallet instruments, or piano, and then after that would probably be trombone is the most logical, maybe some of the woodwinds because of the pattern they go. But even with trumpet, you know, to have a kid... My first trumpet lesson, whenever I would teach privately, our first lesson, I'd always say, all right, let me tell you what the valves do. Because No kid before ever understood what the logic was behind any fingering that they knew and what the valves are actually doing. And so you explain the idea. It's actually seven different bugles, half step, whole step, step and a half. All right, how else can we get a step and a half? Well, you can push the first and second one down. Absolutely, you know, and starting to get them to understand how their instrument works. And I felt like that just helped them like demystify a lot of it so much. But you're right. We don't teach chromaticism at all.
I also don't teach major scales to start with. Like I teach everything based on tetrachords, because two folding your arms.
No. Yeah. I remember hearing dude. This. Yeah. No. Lisa told me this. And I remember thinking like, I want to hear this. This is fascinating. All right, so tell me what the tetrachords and why you're doing that.
Tetrachord is the first four notes of the major scale. So if we're in the key of C, it'd be C, D, E, and C, D, E, F, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to teach a major scale, I don't teach them all eight notes at once, right? We start off by teaching just the very basic C, D, E, and F. And we talk about, and then the day before that, though, we're talking about, and every kid gets a handout of a piano keyboard, and then I flash it up on the screen. And we talk about what a half step and a whole step is. So, and I'll say, all right, now look at this note. Is this a half step or a whole step? And the kids are like, oh, it's a half step, or that's a whole step. So I have them start identifying on the keyboard, right? I also teach them at the same time as this on how to transpose their instrument. When I say, if I say concert B flat, what is that note for you? Oh, well, you know, at this point, it's a G altos because I've been telling you, but you don't know how yet. I'm going to teach you how now. And then they start seeing the half steps and the relationships to that. That's a side story. But the point is they have to understand half steps and whole steps. So then I teach them the formula. We're just going to build a tetrascale starting on C, and we're going to go up a whole step, and a half step. Write that formula down. Great. Now, if I tell you to start on C and I give you that formula, what do you think the second note of this scale is going to be? And then they'll look at it and go, I think it's a D. It sure is. What's the next one? An E? That's right. What about the next one? And they're like, that's the half step. Oh, E to F. That's a half. So it's F. Right. So they're building their own major scales. I'm not telling them what they are. I'm giving mm-hmm. them the rules for them to figure it out. So, and then we do that for all 12 tetrascales. Because since it's only a four-note scale, mm-hmm. it goes pretty quickly. You can do two or three a day and then move on. It's like, all right, now we're gonna. They don't even know how to play the fingerings yet. Don't even care about that yet. We're just building tetrascales and say, all right, well now let's do F sharp. I mean, let's take a few seconds here. F sharp. What's the next note? G sharp. And then we start talking about why it's a sharp and not a something else flat. It's like, well, in major scales, we can't cross over sharps and flats. We just, you know, once we stick with one, that's the one we're going to be with. And they're like, all right, that's fine. So we go through all 12 of those. All right. And then a little bit later, we'll play some of them. And then it's starting to connect the two tetrascales to a major scale. Because if I now start on G and I build that same tetrascale, I'm going to go G, A, B, and C. Well, from G to A is a whole step, from A to B is a whole step, and from B to C is a half step. It's the exact same formula. So mm-hmm. we learn all the tetrascales in the lower octave, and then we learn all of the tetrascales in the upper octave. So we learn the low C tetrascale, then the high C tetrascale, the low F tetrascale, and the high F tetrascale. And then we have this discussion about the circle of fifths going, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go from C to G, the C tetrascale to the G tetrascale. Let's do that together. And then it's a C scale, and they never have to worry about it again.
Holy, okay, hang on. I got my pen and my notebook out. This doesn't make for great podcasting for me to take notes, but that's so good. That's good. Okay, how am I going to write this down? I'm going to figure this out. Okay, genius. Okay, carry on.
And here's the method behind it.
Now, wait a minute.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, and you can... You might even answer this. So how does the percussionist figure all this out? Well, and I don't mean that as insulting as it sounded, but I mean it like, you know, I mean, I know you deal with scales, of course, but like, I don't know, like it's so much, maybe it's because it's so visual with percussion instruments. Like you can see it in front of you. It's not something that exists in your head or only on a piece of paper, but where did this come from?
Part of it came from me hanging out with my college band director, who he was a very much outside of the box type of guy, Dr. Richardson. To me, he was an absolute genius, right? And anybody mm-hmm. who spoke with him either walked away thinking he was a genius or he was completely like out there and, right. and couldn't get around it at all. But I gravitated towards him because of his outside the box type of way for everything. Plus, you know, I felt as though when I started college, I was way far behind, right? And the only thing that I could do pretty well was rhythm because that's why I was in the percussion section. Mm-hmm. So everything that I came from was I have to work as hard as I need to get to catch up to where my peers are in college. So, you know, combine that with like that outside the box thinking. Plus, here was the other thing. 20-something years ago, I was training horses, and I was going to seminars with a horse whisperer, right? That horse whisperer's name was Dennis Reese. So I would spend weekends going to these horse training seminars, and I learned a ton about the education process through watching him train. And okay. he trained horses from – you know, baby colts all the way through like these wild Mustangs that were, you know, that had absolutely no, they were not domestic at all. They were just crazy and wild. And he would take his horse whisper techniques and then demonstrate in front of everybody in the arena, right? And he had a few of these phrases that he continually said. And one of them was, you know, if you take all the time it takes less time. So because in most often times, you know, so you have like two different camps. You have like the old school cowboy and like the new cowboy. The old horse trainer would get on the horse's back, like saddle them up, cinch them in, put the spurs on, climb on their back, hold the reins, kick them in the gut, rum the spurs up and down until finally the horse would just submit, right? Mm-hmm. And then once the horse gave up, well, then the horse whisperer got off and said, well, I trained it. I broke it. It's fine. Look how tough I am now. And look what an amazing horse trainer I am.
Well, right.
You know, folks like Dennis Reese and other – Buck Brannaman was another one, and Gary Hunt. Gary Hunt was kind of like the beginning horse whisperer guy. I mean, he was – you go back and watch and read some Gary Hunt quotes and immediately apply that to education, your life will be easier. I promise you that. Dennis Reese, he would also talk about if you take all the time it takes less time, because we would always tend to get in a hurry, right? So I was training this horse one time, and I was with my dad, and I'm spending all this time from this baby. I put the blanket over it and then take it off, because horses are prey animals. So they automatically think every other mammal is there to hurt them, right? So the first thing you have to do is build trust, just like students have to do, or teachers have to do with students. You build trust. So as you are, putting the blanket on the horse and then taking it off again, you're building that trust, because they realize that blanket is not there to hurt them, right? Then the next step is
after. And for people that are not horse people, we're talking about the saddle blanket that goes over the horse's back that the saddle then sits on top of. Yeah.
Yeah. So then after you realize that the horse is not going to jump, skip, and do all the stuff just because of the blankets on them, then the next step is to put that saddle on. So then you take the saddle on for the first time, and of course the horse is on edge and uneasy and will flinch a little bit, and then mm-hmm. you pull it off and you realize, hey, it's not going to hurt. After you do that enough times, the horse finally gets desensitized and it's fine now. But again, while at the same time, you're building trust. And then I remember one day, like, we were this step close, and I said, all right, I said, Dad, should we go ahead and cinch up the saddle? And he goes, no, that's for tomorrow. And he said, because if you cinch it up now, you might ruin everything you did in the last 2 to 3 hours. And he said, so we'll just come back tomorrow, you know. And then falling in line with that Dennis Reese comment is, if you take all the time it takes less time. He said, if we leave that horse alone today, when we come back tomorrow, we won't have to spend 2 hours. We might have to spend a half an hour, and then we'll be able to finish that saddle. If you take all the time it takes less time, is I use that phrase every single day in the classroom. And it's also I'm also telling the students, but it's a reminder to me, because how many times as a director, like, we're rehearsing and we're pushing and we're like, we got 5 minutes left. And then finally the kids kind of sour at the end, and then they walk out of the rehearsal not feeling very good about the work that they accomplished in the first 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. So it's like, just, you know, take your time. It'll be fine. It'll be okay. How did we get there? Oh, from the Tetra scales. So then the other thing was Dennis Reese would say, prepare to a position to transition. All right. So that concept was also applying to putting a saddle on a horse, is if you are a horse trainer and you take the saddle and you throw it on there and the horse starts jumping, then you did not prepare that horse for that saddle. All you did was throw the saddle on. All right. Mm-hmm. So what steps did you need to take to put that saddle on? Well, you do the blanket and you rub it down and you're, you know, petting the horse and you're building trust and you're doing all of those good things. So in my early stages of teaching, like with every young teacher, we never prepare the students to a position to transition. All we do is transition and hope they follow us. And then for going back to key signatures. All right. If the kids are playing the scale, then the moment that they go into another key, and you did not prepare them to that position to transition into another key, they're going to play a wrong note repeatedly. Mm-hmm. So what can I do to maybe lessen that effect? And that's when I started dissecting the scales a little bit and saying, all right, I want to prepare them to a position to transition into playing all 12 keys or a major scale or whatever the passage is. And then how can I break that into smaller steps? That's where I started doing more and more with the Tetra scales, because that's the smallest step that I could come up with. Is you go from half steps to whole steps to that little formula, that formula twice, scale is done. Instead of going, here's a brand new scale, let's barrel through it together and with all the nasty sounds.
Yeah.
That other concept comes from when we transition from the beginning band method book, whatever it is, like the single line melodies, into the first full piece of music. That's another, you know, how many times as a young director did I like teach from that book or whatever book and then hand out their first real piece of band music where there's two or three things happening at the same time. And you're like, all right, kids, let's do it. And then all of a sudden doesn't sound the way that, you know, you had hoped. So what's the first thing? You're like, come on, kids. I've taught you these notes. I've taught you these rhythms. I've taught all of this stuff. Why does it sound that way? And the answer is because I did not prepare them to a position to transition into full band music. That's what's beneficial about going from a unison line to teaching partner songs, or teaching rounds, then partner songs. And then after you do unison songs, rounds, partner songs, then the next step would be to take a full piece of music that that the publisher sends out, and then that's when I would go through and copy every line into finale. And the first couple pieces of music that we learn as a beginning band is actually a series of unison lines where everybody in the band is playing the exact same thing. And then I'll part it out and say, all right, like, well, everybody, we're going to play the melody, and they'll call that letter A. Now we'll all play the counter melody, letter B. Now we'll all play the bass line, letter C. And then once A, B, and C all sound clean and sound together and the kids are playing it with confidence, I'll say, all right, tell you what, let's have some fun with this. Trumpets and trombones, I want you to play A. Saxes, you play B. Flute, you play C. All right. And we play it. And the kids are like, hey, wait a minute, I can hear the parts working together. And then it's like, all right, well, let's change it up now. Trumpets and clarinets, you play this part. Until finally I morph it into where it's the real piece of music, the way that the composer had intended it.
Yeah.
And then at that point, I was like, and the kids can play it and hear what band music sounds like from the beginning because of that transition. The kids are sold, and it makes sight reading much easier down the line because they're not afraid of it.
What's a partner song?
Oh, a partner song is like two songs that follow the same chord progression and the melodies lock in. Like Paw Paw Patch, that old folk tune, lines up with This Old Man.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, okay. So like half the kids are playing This Old Man, the other half are playing Paw Paw Patch, and the parts are lining up.
So how do you find partner songs? Is this a thing that like one can Google and exists?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've been using the same ones for so long. I haven't like looked up a new partner song in years, but I think
it's just something you figured out.
Yeah. And here's the other thing. I go back to this cross training thing. So when I went in my early days of going to MMEA, I didn't go to a lot of band clinics. I went to choir and orchestra clinics. And then I went to elementary music clinics, right? And so then I was learning their concepts and how they approach things, because those clinics were different from each other and they were different from the band clinics. So by going to those different clinics, I was learning things about partner songs and rounds, because that's what the elementary teachers were doing and what their choir directors were doing in the early stages to get their kids ready for their choral pieces as well. So then I was like, well, how would this concept work in band? And then that's how some of this got morphed as well.
And so why were you going to those things instead of the band stuff? You just weren't interested in the band session that was going on that particular time?
Or you'd spent too much time at
the bar the night before, so you just stumbled in the wrong session and stayed there?
No, not at all. It was more of, because I knew what I was going to hear in those clinics, because I had already had college method classes. I was already, hanging out with other band directors on all district day. I was already hearing, and I'd already picked the brains of those people. Right. Mm-hmm. So I had already had, so instead of just hearing the same thing or the rephrased same thing, It's like, I wanted to hear like, man, how did the orchestra teachers like approach? Because we're all basic in the same way. It's like, it's still melody, harmony, and rhythm, mm-hmm. right? And we're all teaching music. Mm-hmm. And music is music no matter what. It's just the pedagogy that goes specifically with the tools that we use, like a trumpet or trombone or something along those lines. But at the very core, music is music. So how are the choir teachers, the orchestra teachers, and the elementary music teachers teaching these concepts to their kids? And then finding and then coming back going, man, that was really effective. I'm going to use that.
Yeah.
For example, before, you know, we were talking about methods earlier, but the methods that I was explaining earlier, I didn't even start until midway through second quarter, because in the first quarter and a half, we do nothing but Suzuki band. Like all of my kids were playing by ear in the first quarter. I showed them how to put the instrument together, and then I would teach them one note at a time, and it was play by ear. And they were just matching my tone on all the instruments, and they were just matching, you know, my notes and my sounds, because I wanted them to have a concept of sound and being able to play melodies before they got to the method book. Mm-hmm. Because, and then going back to the Dennis Reese talk, prepare them to a position to transition. I mean, my goodness, my first year of teaching, you know, I learned a lot because of all the awful things that I did. But can you imagine walking into a beginning band class going, all right, kids, first day of band, let's put the instruments together. I know you don't know how, but we'll all figure it out. Just put them together. All right. By second day, you're like, let's open up to page one and let's play it all together. Right. And you're rushing through absolutely everything to yeah. where now it's a train wreck. And now what happens if you're a bright kid in class, right? Who has a strong supportive family that are involved in the school, you know, they're struggling a little bit, but you know, they're making it. But then if a kid in the program that has maybe a broken home life or something, and maybe they're not catching on as quickly, that concept of put it together, open up the book will overwhelm them to the point where they'll just go, forget it. It's too much to think about. I mean, in the first 5 minutes, he told me to open up the book, sit up straight, back to off, he flat on the floor, set my embouchure like this, put my fingers like that, because that's what the note's supposed to sound like. Now let's all breathe together and let's all play. You know, mm-hmm. there's like 10 steps. And if a kid misses a couple of them, it's a mess.
And what I know from most band directors, the director probably gave all those instructions by counting off the tune. All right, everybody, you ready? We're going to play this? All right, number one. All right. Get your instruments together. All right. I need everyone to sit up straight. Yeah, I know. Some people just got called out there.
So anyway, I was like, well, prepare them to a position to transition. Like, what? So I started breaking everything up to where even till this day, we start off the school year playing everything by ear. I'm going to show you how to put the instrument together. I'll even make a video of how to put it together so you can study that at home. No problem. Now I'm going to play a few notes. You play a few notes. I'll teach you this fingering. I'll teach you this note name. Now that's about the second half of rehearsal. The first half of rehearsal, we're just doing music theory stuff. Completely unrelated. Wink, wink, nod, nod. Look, let's everybody learn the notes on the treble clef. Let's everybody learn all the notes on the bass clef. Let's everybody learn our counting method, right? So I'm teaching rhythm outside of what is in that book later on down the line, because mm-hmm. it's going to come later. It's not a big deal. So we do the first quarter to quarter and a half strictly by ear, Suzuki, like, and those concepts were taken from orchestra, Suzuki violin. Mm-hmm. And then halfway through the second quarter, or whenever the time is appropriate, it's like, all right, kids, I'm going to show you what this piece of music looks like. That hot cross buns thing we played, here is what it looks like. And now let's dissect it, because you know how to count these rhythms. Yes. You know these note names. Yes. You know these fingerings. Yes. Well, this is what it looks like on the paper. Not so scary, right? Nope. Great. Let's learn some songs now. And then we hit the ground running from there.
I love that idea, Ron, and I love the idea of teaching orally and through rote first, and then basically on paper showing them, this is what you've learned. I was thinking as you're going through that, I remember the first time in jazz band playing a Latin chart in high school, and not being able to, like, I couldn't understand any of the rhythms. Like, I would just look at this page, and it would look super intimidating with a lot of, like, 16th, 8th, 16th rhythms and just things that were very complicated. And then you'd hear it played and you'd think, oh, that's okay. That's not that difficult. Like I can play that. And I even think about the way that I work on music today. So I play with the Missouri Jazz Orchestra, and we're getting ready to start back up again. And so I've got the book, and I go and find all the recordings. If it's a tune I don't know, I have the recording playing through my stereo. And the first time through, I'm just reading my part. And especially for things like Thad Jones and Count Basie, where sometimes the rhythm they play isn't the rhythm that's written, mm-hmm. you know, hearing them play it, like all of a sudden, sometimes there's also complicated rhythms in there. I'm absorbing it so much faster when I hear them do it and then see that on the page, go, oh, that's what that is. Cool. Then if I had to sit and go, all right, let me count out what this rhythm is and just try to figure it out independently. So much better if I can hear it first and then say, all right, you see that thing that you just heard or that thing that you just played? Here's actually what it looks like on the page, and then go, oh, cool. Now I know what that sounds like. So I love this idea of teaching students that way, because even if you're teaching rhythm, if you're teaching a simple rhythm, like, you know, 2 8th notes and a quarter note, if you're just teaching them, just play the sound, bop, bop, ba, and they play it over and over again, cool. All right, well, here's what the rhythm looks like of what you just played. Oh, cool. All right. Mm-hmm. And now I know what that means. I know what that looks like without having to like try to math it out.
You know, we're always quick to say, well, music's a language. Music's a language. It is. And you learn language long before you learn to read. So mm-hmm. you were, you know, kids that are going into four-year-olds and five-year-olds going into kindergarten, their vocabulary is expansive, even if they don't know what all the words mean or what they look like or that sort of thing as they read. So I just wanted to take that same concept into the classroom and say, look, I'm going to teach you how to play music first, and then we'll figure out what it looks like later. And I can tell you that, especially now that I'm an old guy, you know, people who disagree will just blow me off like, ah, he's old. But when I was younger, I got ridiculed a lot. Like, oh no, look, we need to teach literacy. And I was like, I'm teaching literacy, but I'm also teaching rote, and they are just as equal, and mm-hmm. I'll fight you on it. Like, I have no problems defending that. And I even said, look, if you think that my methods are questionable, and if you think that I'm just teaching kids by rote, judge me on how they sight read. After that, you take away your best opinion.
Yeah. Well, you're teaching literacy through rote and through recognition, you know, and it becomes less of a theoretical thing, and it's more of an experiential thing. So a lot of times if we're thinking about sight reading or the way we traditionally would teach music, we're first teaching the theory behind all of it, and then we're trying to get them to actually experience it and then put it into place, which is a little bass-ackwards for something that is an oral art form. Mm-hmm. So if we turn that around, it probably does make a lot more sense to have them hear it first and understand the sound of it first, and then try to understand how you got to that sound. I'm convinced, man. You've got me convinced for sure. That's fascinating.